With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight back. It's time for the publisher fight back.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to episode 8 of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief of Video Ad News, which will soon be rebranding to Video Week. This week's guest is Shingy, who is one of the industry's best-known and most colourful characters. Shingy has worked as both a marketer and as a futurist, firstly with AOL, which were then acquired by Verizon, and he held the job title of Digital Prophet. I think for it to name an industry icon, he'd be close to the top of most people's lists as one of the industry's most recognizable and most interesting characters. Just a reminder that the Video and OTT Advertising Guide will be returning in September, so if your company would like to be involved in the 2021 edition, please get in touch via the Video Ad News website. Now I'll cross over to my chat with Shingy. I always enjoy chatting to Aussies, but I found Shingy to be an exceptionally kind, empathetic, and interesting human being, and I think you will too. So, how did you start your career, and how does one fall into the role of becoming a digital prophet? What's the route?
Oh, Vincent, a great question. Felt like I've had sort of multiple careers, and this manifestation of the prophet was one that came out of a need I saw in the industry. So let me back up. I'm a designer by trade. I'm a classically trained graphic designer, my friend. And, you know, I've been technically curious most of my life, and I've spent most of my time in startups. But I spent a little bit of time initially in London helping AOL out, and at that point AOL UK was taken care of, but they really needed some new territories to be managed, so I came on as head of marketing and media for the new territories. They were known as the new geos at the time, and we launched a ton of countries, and that was all fabulous. And then there was a leadership change, and at that point the leadership was Tim Armstrong came on board, and he came from Google, as you guys know. And, you know, I'd always had a pretty international focus, but at that time they said, look, I think we're going to recede the waters, make sure that we get the right strategy in Europe, and then, you know, come back out and amplify across the rest of the world correctly, because it's really hard to sustain all of it. And I thought that was a really interesting, honest way to approach it. And so I helped the international teams come up with new iconography for AOL. And in that time, we receded some of those territories that we'd launched in Europe, in the new territories. And we also had a leadership change in the UK, and I was a contractor at this point in time, by the way. And then they asked me to come on full time to be the head of media and marketing for all of AOL Europe. And so I had, you know, Germany, France, UK, and ultimately we just focused on the UK. So then the brand iconography happened. And what typically happens with a business that's in transition, you know, although you launch a new brand, it's great for the sort of headquarters, but if you're an outlier division, it's hard to get the attention of the headquarters. And so I was told, you know, here's your brand. Let's, you know, thanks for help developing it. Guess what? Your territory won't get as much focus in terms of marketing money. And so I decided to take a different approach. I thought, well, okay, why wouldn't we then make sure that the B2B space knows us differently? And instead of the context of just being a media house trying to push media wares, why don't we talk about the industry? So I'd been in the industry talking about it for a while, sitting on panels and whatever, being a thought leader as they were called back then. And, you know, more and more increasingly, I was spending more time sort of focused on sort of the evangelism of the industry more so, because I felt like it was good to be able to come up with ideas and help people push those ideas agnostically. And then obviously how it falls into media, and particularly how it falls into our media. So that was really the lifeblood of it all. And then at one point, my boss at the time, Tim Armstrong and Kate Burns from the UK said, look, we think this is a global need. So will you join us as full-time evangelist? And I said, sure, but I don't want to be called an evangelist. Why don't, you know, Google has them, Microsoft has them. There's plenty of those. Why don't I come up with something more playful and fun? And that's where I came up with the profit. And so that's where that all came from. And, you know, it was really just to create some energy and creativity around an industry that really needed a different point of view in my mind, because it all felt very homogenized.
I mean, what do you think of those, you know, the Armstrong years? I have to say, when he was serving as CEO, I was a bit of a fan, and I thought I loved the ambition that he had, and I felt like the vision of, you know, matching ad tech along with media, which at the time was particularly important for video, where publishers in particular didn't have access to their own video content. They didn't know how to create it. And there was, in theory at least, you know, scope for a sort of real synergy of having those two divisions. But, you know, there was a huge M&A spree, particularly on ad tech, you know, for everyone from Adapt TV to Millennial Media and numerous others. And I think, you know, I remember meeting some of the AOL execs at a press briefing in Cannes. And, you know, I sort of asked the question, you know, how is this all going to fit together and which components are you going to be keeping? And you could sort of see that, you know, the various people involved, you know, it was the heads of the various divisions, generally didn't know yet, you know. What were the main strengths and weaknesses of Verizon's strategy as somebody who was inside sort of seeing it all play out?
Armstrong years, I actually think it was absolutely remarkable. And as somebody who wasn't full-time, I didn't have to necessarily join as a full-time. But when I heard the vision, as you say, of mixing media with ad tech, but also choosing the hardest media, the most expensive, hardest to scale, sort of before it's way ahead of its time, was video, right? And TA, or Tim, was really focused on making sure he was going to invest in all of that and have a discipline around it. And also to make sure it wasn't just going to be singular site. So in the media space, it wasn't just one domain, it was going to be multiples. So not only was there ad tech acquisition, there were media acquisitions. And I thought, wow, what a great strategy to distribute to where people find common interests, and then to go wider where they have really narrow interests. And at the time, weren't really catered by social, and social groups weren't really there, and all the other socials weren't really there. It was really good to go use case by use case. And the strategy worked. Ultimately, you know, AOL sold to Verizon in the billions, and so job well done for what was at the time a company that was going from, you know, pipes to content. And then suddenly it went, you know, it sold back to pipes, which I think was absolutely remarkable. And here's the thing that's also incredible. Those people that you probably met that owned those divisions or those companies at the time didn't see the foresight of how programmatic was really going to revolutionize the industry. But Tim was way ahead of that. So to be able to artfully have beautifully curated content and try and apply that against smart ads. So we had a concept called Devil Ads. The idea was to take an idea from sort of magazine. If you look at curation, magazines have done an incredible job of, you know, making you wade through 20 beautiful ads before you get to any editorial, because the ads feel like editorial. How do you do that across the internet? And that was really done with Devil Ads. Because what we'd done prior to that, mate, is that, you know, we had access as somebody who ran media or marketing. We had access to 728s and by 90s and 300 by 200s. And, you know, these are little banner ads that were really cut across the internet. So it gave you scale, but it didn't give you brand panache. And so there are new formats needed to happen. So while as much as programmatic really was being birthed, and, you know, I think Tim really did help pioneer why programmatic was going to be strong, we were also doing these beautiful ads with Devil. And ultimately, it was lots of experimentation, lots of play, also lots of investments in things like iPad apps and, you know, phone apps at the time, all things that really, they all really do matter. And by the way, if you circle back around, they're still current today. It's just a different type of discipline. And so, I had a really good time. It was really, I think that whole tenure was incredibly powerful. Sad to see Tim leave in terms of leadership, but, you know, he's it was very well respected in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was a lot of brave moves as well. You know, things like Go 90, which you'll often get, and the first people to criticize moves like that are people who, you know, they've stayed in the same job for 15 years and, you know, not really done anything innovative. But, you know, it was worth a shot. You know, it was worth, you know, you could might argue that Quibi should have learned from good 90s mistakes. You know, at the time, I think it was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And
yeah, you know, and you can't, otherwise what's going to happen is you'll end up going to five domains, and who wants to do that? And, you know, if you think about it, today's currency, you talk about Quibi, no doubt, perfect timing for a bad release. But at the same time, if you think about other places that have exploded, like TikTok, which was foundations of Musical.ly,
yeah,
I mean, that's a perfect location of the perfect time, because people just want pure entertainment in a meme culture. And wow, you know, so there is room for innovation, but there is also room for adoption, which ultimately makes it matured. And, you know, there's if you play it like a portfolio, which is really what the AOL strategy was well prior to Verizon, you end up with some incredible outcomes and people that really do love some of those domains, like TechCrunch is beloved, Engadget is beloved, HuffPost is beloved. You know, there's some really good architecture there. And sort of, you know, who knows who it's powered by and how that works. So again, it wasn't single domain trying to make this thing a monster. It was creating a multitude of experiences for people to delight them where they need to be met. And again, the ambition I thought was great. The ad tech piece, programmatic. Wow. That's all people talk about today. And yet, you know, you and I are missing out on Cannes this year. The truth is that Cannes Lion, you know, to celebrate creativity is still something that really is worthy of it. It's just how is that explored now is just different than anything we've seen previously, you know.
So what have you been up to personally since leaving Verizon?
Yeah, so it took a little bit of time just to sort of catch my wind. If you sit on a plane for hundreds of days a year, I've been wearing a mask on my face for years, by the way, and somebody who's part Asian, I can get away with it and not look crazy. Or I look crazy anyway, so I just add to the crazy, I guess. But it's been nice not to be on one. So, it's been really nice. But I've been, you know, I've been educating groups that I feel like I want to listen to. So, you know, I've taken on some really some. It's almost like it's not PSA because that would be it's kind of a rubbish way of captivating that. But you know, I've been educating some groups who normally wouldn't have access to people in the industry so widely, and also just participating. So I then become the student. So I've been doing a lot of that, Vincent Riches. You know, as somebody who's an output entirely, so, you know, I'm kind of like somebody who constantly is on the fire hose itself at the end of holding it, it's been great to receive. And so, you know, to answer your question directly, I've enjoyed becoming a student again. So I've done a lot of that. I've spent time speaking at places that I care about, but more importantly, listening to those people. So that's been incredibly valuable to me. And I've also spent, you know, I've tried to spend a lot of times off planes, really, and I'm just catching my breath, which has been exquisite. And also wondering about where human behavior goes and how their relationship with technology is really going to evolve, because as somebody who suffers from false vibration syndrome,
yeah,
probably a dozen times a day, my leg will false vibrate. It's kind of nice just to take a moment out and figure out what, you know, what this all means and the sum total of it, you know?
Yeah, I think quite a few people I've spoken to have been really enjoying lockdown and the break from travel, time with their families. Mm. And, you know, and that's not to say that it's been easier for everyone. It certainly hasn't. And obviously, you know, the health crisis looms large in the background for everyone.
Amen.
But yeah, there certainly is a lot of people are sort of rethinking their life direction. And even for us as a business, and, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of our fellow people in the trade press, you know, we've seen our events business, you know, evaporate overnight, and it's just really interesting seeing how everyone adapts. And actually, I think this sort of segues into my next question. I think one of the joys of lockdown for me has been this time to have a bit of blue sky thinking of, okay, how do we reconfigure what we do? How do we offer, you know, think differently? And a lot of people, a lot of companies don't actually have somebody who, you know, is dedicated to thinking like that, you know, to looking at the future. And, but, you know, for you personally, you know, has the role of digital profit been a burden or a blessing? You know, I think sometimes the practitioners in the industry, the people, you know, who, you know, they have a desk job, they're slightly resentful about the people who go around to events and get to sort of think about the future. And, you know, for you personally, has it been a burden or a blessing? And, you know, have there been many predictions in the past that you've gotten wrong, or are there any that, you know, you're particularly proud that you got right?
Yeah, good, really good question. And I would say that I've been able to counterbalance both being a practitioner and being somebody who runs in theory.
Yeah.
But I've also had a really good, my fair share of people trying to have a go, which I'm absolutely fully aware of and thank them, frankly, because all it's done is highlighted the need for what I do and has made me incredibly popular through that time. Because the internet really did come at me a couple of times, and bless them, because thank you, you made me really, really popular. And so I think what's really interesting is it's never been a burden, mate. It's an absolute blessing. And by the way, if you're doing something, if you don't have criticism or you don't have critics, then you're definitely not doing something right in my mind. So it's been a gift. This entire experience has been a gift. And, you know, there are companies that I consult to, which is exactly what I want to do. It's to talk about these theories, but actually put the principles in play that are in areas that I really care about, like contactless. You know, I've been playing around with technologies for quite some time and seeing it, but wow, this time right now, the whole idea of contactless. I mean, even as a marketer, I was thinking to myself, wow, why didn't QR codes really take off for me as a marketer at the time? Well, part of it was design, right? So how do you put a design layer on something that really does give you the ability to have contact? Or NFC has been late for things like iPhone. So why hasn't that really taken off? So, you know, now is the time to explore the intersection of technology and connection, I think. And so that's been one thing. And also, you know, it has been a time where I've been able to write about it, but also see in practice whether it does play. So it's not just all sort of spouting, which thankfully has never been the case, even if you're an entrepreneur inside a company. But, you know, now that I'm out, I have the ability to sort of be more entrepreneurial of my own time and my own thinking anyway. So, no, but to answer your question directly, it's been a real blessing.
Yeah. What about the prediction side? Is it?
Yeah. Sorry, you asked.
I do that sometimes. I ask 20 questions at once.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So predictions, I got a couple wrong badly and I got a couple of rippers right. And so the one that I'm probably, the one I think was about 2012 maybe-ish. I don't know when it is, 2012, 2011, something like that. I said that defriend unfollow was going to be a trend. And people thought I was batshit crazy, but the truth is, I was absolutely right. And if you look upstream now, I just got the how it's going to be applied wrong. Because if you look upstream, are you, by the way, Vincent, are you on Instagram?
I have an account I don't use. I've never done a single post. So I just, logged in to see.
Check
something.
You out. Okay. So, wow, crappy audience of one.
Yeah.
But if we were to talk to a bunch of kids today, young adults, whatever, and ask about Instagram, I will tell you that probably greater than 50% of them put their hands up and say that they're private. And prior to TikTok's fundamental burst, I would have said that Instagram was the last of the open social medias because there's lack of trust. And there's what we've seen with the data scares a couple of years ago. So what's happening is more people are locking their accounts down, or they're spending more time in SMS, or they're spending more time in places like WhatsApp, WeChat, etc. Line, other places like that, which are all closed networks. And why? Because they feel like there's a better interconnected sort of relationship there. So that was one where, you know, I was early in on it, and I think it was absolutely right, just the wrong time, the wrong application of it. There was one where I completely got it wrong, which I still, the context was taken out of context, but it's true. It was wrong. I said that apps were rubbish. And the truth is, clearly they're not. It's just that we have less of them. And what I meant by that at this point in time was that too many people were taking what's available on the web and just creating an app out of it. And this was early to maybe 2012, 2013, something like that. And the truth is that was completely wrong. And that's okay, because awesome. As somebody who is coming to you via an app now.
Yeah.
And here's what I really meant, by the way. What I was really trying to say, but obviously my context was wrong, was that the operating system of mobility hasn't really adapted or changed and evolved to people's needs. And I thought that the best example of one that did was Microsoft's phones application. So its OS, I thought, was really ambitious. It was really lovely, a bit too primary color for me, but it had this lovely concept. And it just didn't play. Everyone else was little tiny squares on a home screen. You had to sort of slide five or six of those to find out what app was at the very end. Where Microsoft, I think, were taking a different approach, and I was really inspired by it. But obviously I wasn't able to articulate that correctly at the time, but I thought their iOS ambition was pretty game on.
And the app, I'm sure all the statistics defy my own personal experience, but for me, I'm not downloading apps very often. It's very much for me, it's almost a utilitarian thing now where I'm just downloading something in order to do something, whether it's an event or an airline or whatever else. And I have my core, you know, music, audio, all those different things. But I'm not particularly, and maybe it's I'm getting old and have a lack of curiosity, but I'm not particularly curious about new apps that are out there in the market. There isn't the same buzz.
Vincent, it's not you. Yeah. It's not you. No. The average number of apps downloaded per month is zero. It's incredibly difficult to get people to download apps.
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult. Why? Because of exactly what you just said. So you have this euphoric moment where you have this device. It's like, oh, this is absolutely delicious. I've gone from 8 inches to 10 inches. Wow, look how amazing I can do this. And you know, you end up rebooting your phone. You end up downloading all the same apps you have. And you sit there and go, my God, the only thing I really use is my camera, text, maybe email and calendar if you've got any sort of job next to you. And then you've got a bunch of social apps you use. And then utilities. The thing you said, you've answered your own question. So if you're a keen fisherman, you may want to find out what the tides are. If you're an incredible, you know, sports person, you may just be gobsmacked on this sort of content of, you know, it may be broadcast. It may be just how to do the next best swing. But what you aren't going to do is fill your phone up with all of these different things and just go and say, that's it, man. It is now app roulette. It's very, very difficult. And most of those apps are utility-based. So let me tell you again, when I ask people this in large groups, who's downloaded an app recently, and I get a smattering of hands, I'll ask them what it is. And if they say to me, and I'll say, what is that? When was the last time you opened it? Have you opened it since? Or whatever, you know, when you downloaded it, did you open it? Okay. How many times have you used it since you downloaded? Oh, one or two? Okay, then it's useless. That's not utility. That was a purpose of something you did. And by the way, 9 times out of 10, it is something based on utility. I was at an event, I downloaded the thing. Or I needed to buy tickets, so I decided I'll buy it through this system because it's the fastest way to do it. But it was an app, but I haven't gone to it since. Or better still, I'm not going to go to that event, apparently. But, you know, there are things that are happening that it's just very hard. It's very hard to create new behaviors.
Which technology in the market are you genuinely excited about right now? You know, it's something that marketers can access today that you think is exciting. And I ask this as somebody who I get asked this question all the time as well, particularly about video and TV. And to be honest, I get harder and harder. Going back to the app innovation, the innovation within our industry as well gets harder and harder to come up with something kind of new or sexy.
That's why that question is also, it's a great question, although it's challenging to pinpoint it, because if you were to look at tech innovation, you know, we see broadly a number of big categories like wearables. Awesome. Category I love and adore. But do I really think that's something that marketers can really fold into potentially incredibly well versus the phone? Maybe not. But if they're in the space of helping somebody with a behavior change or a habit, maybe then that particular device and that technology applied with the right application is a good utility. But what we're finding is that, you know, things like wearables, there are splintering, even wearables are splintered into categories now, fitness, health, habits. You know, there's categories within categories. So you end up instead of saying everybody on planet Earth is going to walk around with a Fitbit, they don't. They're going to walk around with all these different splintered devices that do certain things. So if you're talking about technologies I'm excited about in mass, it's still the number one thing. You know, there's 2 billion phones on planet Earth. So why wouldn't I want that device? You know, so if you think about that, that's probably a good play. But if you think about emerging markets, clearly it's all about cell phones. It's nothing about anything else. It's all about these smartphones. So I'm excited. I'm still excited about the technology that we all have on our device. I would like it to be a bit more open with the way that data is collected on that and how that's utilized. You know, but if you can make something super successful on a device that is in portrait mode and it has incredible utility and not necessarily, I'm talking about maybe habit changing, but not become addictive. That's powerful, but it's still the standard one. There aren't any new real places where you're like, oh, guess what? I discovered this thing that millions and millions of people are on. That means you're no longer discovering them. But I do think these splinters of technologies are fascinating. There's a company that was that were doing a fresh air mask, and I remember presenting on them, about 3 years ago. But, you know, they can't make enough of those things, mate. It basically looks like a plastic face mask that you put around you, like a visor around your face. But there's a window. So you can actually see somebody's expression. You can see them smiling or you can see them frowning or whatever. Because masks today, they're covering your face and you can't see what their facial expression looks like.
Yeah.
But these guys were on it, man. The AOWare. And I thought what was really interesting about it was that that's a piece of technology that is also relevant. As more and more of these cities get congested, you know, people are going to have to do something about breathing fresh air. And that's really what their play was, not viruses. But it's really time. And that technology isn't anything to do with marketers. That technology has got to do with keeping people alive. So it's fascinating, right?
It's interesting times. I think, as we sort of said earlier, I think there's going to be a reset in the way we think about everything. I think everything from commercial properties is something I could talk about all day these days, which is something what's going to happen and how will it be used?
Yeah. Well, let's cover that for a second, shall we? But commercial properties should be given over to artists and they should be able to do things that feel like they're going to create a vibrancy in a city, in my mind. And those places that can work from home, they should be offering that to people because they're going to find their productivity goes up. But the flip side of that is making sure people don't over-index too much on work and they get a life-work balance. Because I don't know about you, man, I'm working harder today than ever before and I'm not in an office and I'm it is different for me. But there's also a work-life balance. So that's my take on commercial, which is the vibrancy of the city is not the masses of people coming in being homogenized. It's the artists that keep it really brittle. And we need more of that in those spaces, in my mind, because they've all left. So that's one challenge. But can I say, Vincent, just to add, you know, one technology I am very excited about, which is not new, is obviously the technology for connecting with people in the car. And the reason why I find that to be fascinating is that I believe a car will be a service, and it already is. Meaning, you lease a car today, and you make payments on that car, but your insurance is separate. But I suspect that as we do move into autonomy, based on your safety rating of a car, for example, you may qualify for different types of insurance that comes with that car. And so safer the car, less the insurance, and more time you've got in front of the screen. So instead of a car payment being the bulk of that car, it may be all the supplementary services you apply to the dashboard that become the value of that car company. So it's not the steel they're making. It's the technology in the car to allow people to have more time to engage. Where I think that technology is going to be absolutely fascinating if autonomy really does get to a point that it's going to be en masse. Other than that, everything is incremental change. Televisions. I do not have a television, haven't had one in 20 years. But when I look at these TVs, they are absolutely gorgeous. And you've got these incredible smart televisions now that have AI built into them. I'm like, AI and television, why would that be needed? Well, instead of having to turn the lights off to watch a beautiful motion picture now in your living room, the TV can adjust to the ambient of the light and create this environment for you just on the fly in 4K in broadcast. That's incredible technology. So if someone is going to build a beautiful advertising experience or a sponsored experience around that, it's going to be seen realer than real. So I don't know, man. I'm excited by screen technologies outside of the ones that, you know, as I said, gives me false vibration syndrome. And I'm excited about whether, you know, services can be played into places that are just interesting and less shiny object, but more about just connecting, I guess.
So what about AR and VR, the two things that I've been you're speaking to the proud owner of VRmarketer.com, which is not a website yet, but I was very hopeful and very bullish, and still am, I think. But, you know, do you think that they're going to become as mainstream as was once suggested? Or
Vincent, you know as well as I do that those things have been around 20 years and they've just evolved. Now, I think that VR had its moment in 2017. And since then, it has become super niche. And I'm thrilled that it is, because the ability from a marketer perspective. So whether it becomes mass, who knows? But to create content in VR is incredibly difficult, as you know, expensive, time-consuming, restricted pixelation, blah, blah. And the number one scent that the sense that's missing in VR is obviously scent. So it's great, except for scent is missing. So it doesn't really give you that full experience. But in terms of narrow casting, oh, it's phenomenal, man. There is nothing better than VR from taking you to a place that's narrow. But it's not really designed for broadcast. Broadcast is where AR is. And I think, look, we might call it AR, but the kids will call it a filter, won't they? And so to adding 3D on a 2D dimension is phenomenal. And that's where AR wins for me. And it's inexpensive, it's updatable, it's highly shareable. That means, you know, it's one of those KPIs that a CFO is going to dig coming out of the marketing team. So it's just something that feels, it feels like it has more buoyancy and has the ability to adapt and change quicker.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing today, there's nothing cool about the design of VR headsets that makes you feel like you integrated into society because it takes you so out of it, which is also a beautiful thing. But if that's the case, we should lean into it, you know, and not try and blend it. But, you know, I think we'll see. We'll see what happens with people like Magic Leap or whatever, but I suspect it's going to be pretty niche anyway and very expensive and will be based on particular vertical needs. So, you know, education, remote learning, training, all of those things that we've seen today, they'll just be a lot better.
So what do you think of the way that video and TV is, you know, the way they're evolving? You know, are the clients still happy with the, you know, the big brand reach that TV advertising delivers for them, or are they looking for something new and innovative?
Well, I think that, you know, linear television, if you, you have to break it down, right? They're not all treated the same. So I think the metrics of broadcast or linear television, you know, there's some speculation that they're not necessarily getting the value of the eyeballs or the attention. We know that. That's been going on for many years. And I would say there's many in the camp saying that they're doing it just because it's a habit. But I do think OTT is pretty amazing. And the ability to sort of still captivate people on a 60-inch TV or whatever they have in their living rooms, but they're just consuming it completely differently. So that's already changing on their behalf. And so I think, you know, yes, they're excited about it because it's a way of getting to people who are watching the content that they care about. The challenge with that is, as a brand advertiser, how are you going to do that? So I think there's going to have to be innovation around there that goes away from just being ads, because more and more people are probably willing to pay for no ads. So how do you actually brand integrate, one, and then how do you also contemplate, not just brand integrate, but then how do you contemplate other ways to bring your message to them? And, you know, branded content is one piece that we've seen for many, many years, but is there powered by, brought to you by, partnered with? Is there a buyer association that's even more interesting? And we've seen some of those models as well. You know, you get people who, you know, if you've got particular shows that are really interesting, people within those shows themselves can align with a brand and do things like launch music, songs from that are featured in the show, and they're actually the singer and they come out with an album, and can a brand associate with that? Contagion. So there's lots of things that I think there's lots of room for innovation out of the traditional models that we've seen previously, because let's face it, people apparently are watching lots of video, particularly on linear, particularly on OTT, and on-demand services have never been hotter. And you see that with things like Disney Plus, but advertising in those domains are far more interesting and have to be more creative than ever before.
So it's a week of the Cannes Lions, so I think we should give a nod to the annual tradition of talking about data and creativity and then not really doing a huge amount about it for the rest of the year. But, you know, but one of the things you notice in Cannes is often you'll have the creative set will often, you know, gather in their own hotels, and you'll have the tech crowd on certain boats or parties, and there's still a sort of division. I think it's, you know, it's probably... maybe it's just a left brain, right brain thing. But, you know, are these worlds coming together? I mean, they aren't socially. So I find it hard to imagine how they're doing it professionally. Do you think this is something that's actually changing the industry, or you know, are there examples of brands doing it right and getting it right?
Well, I think there are. And it comes down to the brand itself and its confidence. Less, you know, agencies aren't going to change for the sake of having to change, for the sake of their own change. They have to. And that demand comes from the clients, right? But if you've got, I don't know. I don't know if it's so black and white. I do think it's blended. I do think you've got agencies that really do understand how data vernacular works and business vernacular and do a really good job of it. And you know, they also do a great job of understanding that the marketer themselves isn't somebody who's just looking at brand advertising. They're looking at product changes, you know, and you see that. And you see that in the product changes that happen. And that leadership is many times driven by marketing, which is then amplified through agency, whether it's their own or others. And so I would say that, yeah, there is a blend happening. Is it happening organically? I think it's being forced by the client because they're so much smarter, or have to be anyway. Because, look, man, the idea of saying I'm going to be a brand advertiser and I really want to make sure people can recall my brand, that creative probably should be held against the same type of creative that's trying to drive sales overnight. So brand over time, sales overnight are two different types of creatives, but we see them blend in the middle. And that's where technologies start to blend in the middle. And programmatic has been the monster in the middle there because it gives you scale, but the formats aren't so sexy. So that's where brand advertising becomes so incredible. But I would say at this moment with this pause, what it's done is also allowed people to think about creativity differently. And you just need to be different and creative, right? So as opposed to it being these gorgeous, languid, long stories shot stunningly that feel more like film than commercials, as an example of what you see as a working can, innovation can happen with just a great idea amplified. So, you know, in this time of pause, I thought some of the car companies did a tremendous job of saying how to do social distancing. It's like VW, for example, did their logo and they decoupled the V and the W, and Audi did the same thing. So they have kind of the Olympic rings logo, as you know, and the iconography was it just four circles. Mercedes did the same thing where they take the tri-star in the center and they pulled the tri-star away from the center so it's not connected. I thought the BMW was very ambitious with just a beautiful piece of work that they just put out on social, and it could turn up as a poster at some point in time. But it was basically sheer non-driving pleasure because they are the sheer driving pleasure. And I just thought, wow, that is such a beautiful little tweak to a brand to apply to today's moment. If you look at somebody like Nike recently did, you know, just don't do it. And I thought that was pretty amazing to talk about racial ignorance. And then Adidas came along, their largest competitor, and just said, yeah, kind of what they'd said. And I just thought, wow, man, not only are we seeing changes happen in the industry, we're seeing changes happen in the empathy of brands, which is, you know, that's when we start to see them humanize. That's when we start to see them reflect back cultural changes as they're marketing and really do it in a way that feels empathetic. At the same time, they're going to try and make sure that their brand is recalled. But I just thought, wow, okay. You know, there's this piece that I've noticed is that I did decide to subscribe to some streaming thing because I wanted to see what the ads were looking like this time, right? And they're all PSA ads, and it's probably the same in the UK. It's probably the same everywhere. But the ads are just basically either somebody hawking something you don't need, almost like on a QVC style, or it's all PSA. But the PSAs have a particular rhythm in these times, in these trying times, in these unprecedented times. And the next thing is, over the last 100 years, when we established 100 years ago, back in 1840 when we established, you go look at this and think, oh, my goodness, there's a pattern here. And it felt like for a couple of weeks when nobody was advertising but everybody was watching television that you know, one agency was producing all the work and it was for different brands. But then I'm starting to see sort of sproutings of just brands that felt like have got out of a fog and woken up and went, okay, this is not a moment. This is a movement all around the world, which is not just that we have to be distant and different as people, but we have to be far more aware as people. And this has changed. So what does it mean for our brand? And, oh, my God, it's incredible what's happening. Now, if agencies can actually captivate on that and understand how to amplify that in a way that makes it feel super relevant and unique, I think it's a beautiful time. I think Cannes Lions would be very different if we were able to be there today, this year.
I think the
work from 12 months ago wouldn't reflect it. I'm sorry, Vincent, you were going to say?
No, I agree with you. It feels like there's a sincerity there from brands about this purpose-driven brand thing that I think before I used to be a little bit skeptical. I saw so many companies, you know, do a lot of greenwashing, particularly in the sort of 90s and early 2000s. And it sort of feels like, no, that we're actually buying into this. And we're not only we're doing that, but we're incorporating this message into our corporate values and making quite ambitious public commitments on issues in a lot of cases. So it does feel like there's a sea change.
There's also, and there's a real subtlety to it if they do it right. And why is that? Because people are spending more time listening. I think some more time being considered. There was one that I distinctly remember without even having to look it up. There's it was just a simple post I saw somewhere on social. I was thumbing through one day, trying not to do it. And I follow BMW Motorrad, the motorbike division of BMW, and they did this beautiful post. Because you think about it, it's one of the things you can do by yourself. and it was just a road, picture of a road, and had a when you receive a call. And it just said, the road is calling. Nice. And I thought, oh, lovely, lovely, lovely. How considered, how subtle. It wasn't a statement of, it's one of the only things you can do right now and you're already wearing a mask, blah, blah, get on the road. You know, it's just really considered. And I thought, wow, that's kind of just that's a gentle reminder that, yeah, man, you know, people are marketing to humans, thank God.
Right, one final question. If you had 10 million to invest in a company or a sector, if you can't think of a specific company, where would you invest the money and why?
That's an interesting question. You know, I probably should have read your questions before you emailed me.
Probably should have.
Problem, but I didn't. That's probably why I wafted on. My apologies, Vincent.
That's the one that I always think people are going to need a bit of time to prepare for. So
yeah, I have $10 million. I'll tell you what I would invest in, mate. I would invest in, and it's already shown, I think, that it's we're there, is that anything in the plant-based food sector for me is the revolution. And, you know, you want to see changes in technology, that's remarkable. But, you know, the truth is, as the ocean is boiling, the greenhouse gases from manufacturing, from meat consumption, which is a human right, not a need, excuse me. I would say that, anything in the vegetable space, for sure, as I choke to death. One second. How ironic.
It's a huge space, and Sophie in our office, she's our vegan in residence, will be delighted with your answer. She gets quite excited when anyone's dietary requirements are vegan for our event. So that's a nice way to finish. Okay,
well, I'm also a chef by training, so I've eaten everything but the oil for many years. And so for me, technology that helps the planet and also helps humans kind of have a better experience, that's where I think that investment would be incredible. And I'm sorry it's not a shiny object, but it's definitely something that will help humans move forward.
That's great. We can have noble investments on here too. It doesn't have to be all media and ad tech. Okay, thanks so much for taking the time. And yeah, best of luck with your new venture. I look forward to seeing what you're coming up with next.